Good morning. You may be seated. The first case on our calendar is 2310 and 2311-07, State of Ohio versus Adam David Jones and Sean Michael Skropitz. Mr. Caldwell.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Mark Caldwell. I'm here from the Stark County Prosecutor's Office, and I'll be representing the State of Ohio in this criminal appeal this morning. I request 3 minutes for rebuttal. The issue in this case is whether a traffic stop of a motor vehicle by a police officer outside of his territorial jurisdiction is unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment when that officer has probable cause to make the traffic stop since he has personally observed the traffic violation committed by the vehicle. The court below held in a 2-1 decision that the traffic stop under these circumstances was unreasonable. In so holding, the court held that the police officer had no reasonable suspicion of criminal activity either at the site of the accident, which was within the police officer's jurisdiction, or at any of the locations which the officer proceeded to in his investigation outside the jurisdiction. The court concluded that the police officer had no jurisdiction to stop the motor vehicle when he saw the vehicle proceeding at night without its headlights on.
Counsel, what expansion of a rule of law would be involved in this case?
Essentially taking this court's 2002 decision in Weideman, which held that the extraterritorial traffic stop supported by probable cause was not per se unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. And to the extent that that may have created a loophole that the court below may have felt that while it wasn't per se unreasonable, there might be circumstances in which such a extraterritorial stop might be. I think that question was answered earlier this year by the United States Supreme Court in Virginia versus Moore. In that case, Justice Scalia, writing for everybody on the court except for Justice Ginsburg, who concurred in the judgment, rejected the argument that the Fourth Amendment should incorporate state law limitations on the law of arrest. So pursuant to Moore, the constitutional reasonableness of the seizure is wholly independent of the state law that governs the arrest or the seizure in that case.
Okay, so I'm still struggling with, isn't this just a call on whether factually it's a valid stop or not?
Well, I certainly agree that there are factual elements to this case, but I think the basic problem was that the Court of Appeals adopted an erroneous legal standard in reviewing the facts of this case. Its review was flawed in two respects. First, it used an overly restrictive view of what constitutes criminal activity. In its view, the traffic offenses that were involved in this case would not constitute criminal activity for purposes of the Fourth Amendment. In addition,
that is driving without a headlight.
That's
headlights
correct.
On.
That's correct. The second aspect in which the analysis of the court was flawed was that it implicitly looked to the reasons for the extraterritorial activity of the police officer as impacting upon the constitutionality of the subsequent stop. The court repeatedly looked at and concluded that there was no reasonable suspicion of criminal activity either at the site of the accident, which was located within the jurisdiction of the police officer, or at any other locations to which he proceeded as part of his investigation. The line of precedent from this court, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court, has held that the extraterritorial nature of the stop is constitutionally irrelevant under the Fourth Amendment. This court's seminal case in 1980, City of Kettering versus Holland, concluded that violations of this territorial jurisdiction statute were statutory in nature and did not rise to the constitutional level. Thus, the application of the exclusionary rule to violations of this statute was improper. Again,
what,
this court...
Uh, what enforcement of the statute then would there be? What incentive to abide by it would a police officer have?
Well, I think there'd be practical restrictions on his activities. For instance, I think any police department that hires their policemen are going to restrict them primarily to the jurisdiction.
Okay, but if I understand your interpretation, there is no downside to a police officer or a law enforcement officer who makes arrests, conducts investigations, what have you, outside their jurisdiction.
Except for the Fourth Amendment restrictions.
Which you indicate aren't non-existent.
Well, he has to have probable cause.
Well, but that would be true inside his jurisdiction.
That's correct.
So there is no downside to...
There's no effective restriction in that case. That's
so the constable in some little village would have no downside to setting up his operation out in the county?
Not constitutionally. Again, there might be a downside in terms of politically that he's monitoring the traffic patterns of a adjoining jurisdiction and not the one for which he's been hired for.
Could the General Assembly adopt a sanction if it wanted to?
Yes, Your Honor. The state could impose the exclusionary rule as a possible sanction for violations.
Or something less than the exclusionary rule, I guess.
Or something less, that's correct. An analogy I would make would be in the area of the speedy trial provisions. The constitutional provision of speedy trial is really quite broad. It's a reasonableness standard. But the Ohio General Assembly has adopted specific time periods that fit within that more general reasonableness standard and has set the sanction for violation as dismissal of the prosecution.
I had the same inquiry that Justice Pfeiffer did. It seems the General Assembly is, by not creating a sanction to a prohibitory statute or limiting statute on police, that by not also including a sanction, they leave open the argument that's made by defense counsel. Well, it's the Fourth Amendment. That's the sanction, and that's logical, but our case law doesn't seem to follow that.
That's correct. And again, I would note that you did dissent, Justice Pfeiffer, in the Weideman case, essentially, I think, making this argument that the violation of the statute should constitute a constitutional violation as well, thereby invoking the exclusionary rule. But again, I think the U.S. Supreme Court in its recent Moore decision has answered that question and has effectively held that any state law restrictions have no impact on Fourth Amendment adjudications of traffic stops or any other stop or seizure outside, in this case, the jurisdiction of the police officer. I think also another analogy or an area of law that could be looked to that's somewhat similar is the area of pretextual stops. This court, as well as the United States Supreme Court, in this court's Erickson decision and the U.S. Supreme Court's Wren versus United States decision, has held that all the Fourth Amendment requires for a stop is probable cause. And the fact that probable cause may be a pretext for other purposes and motivations of the police officer is, for purposes of the Fourth Amendment, irrelevant. Another flaw, I think, with regard to the court's opinion below is it ignored the balancing approach that this court took in Weideman. It followed this balancing test that the U.S. Supreme Court adopted for reviewing the reasonableness of Fourth Amendment seizures. The two-pronged test involves first looking to see whether the action involved was regarded unlawful at the time that the Fourth Amendment was adopted. Obviously, in dealing with traffic offenses, this is not going to come into play. The second prong is balancing or weighing the competing interests that are involved. In the context of traffic stops, we're looking at the protection of the public from drivers who endanger others versus the driver's right to unhindered travel, or right of privacy, if you will. This court concluded in Weideman that the public's interests outweigh the individual's interests in the narrow context of traffic stops, since they involve momentary and limited restrictions of the driver's freedom. Thus, if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Caldwell. Mr. Reach.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Stephen Reach, and I represent Adam Jones. Adam Jones was the driver of this vehicle that was stopped two jurisdictions away from where this officer was employed. And I think the reasonableness test that Mr. Caldwell mentioned is what should be used here. And I think what the Fifth District did, in their opinion, is they used that reasonableness test beginning with the point the officer left his jurisdiction. I think what they did was say the analysis of reasonable and articulable suspicion in an extraterritorial stop begins at the point the officer crosses that line. And in this case, when Sergeant Hirschberger crossed that line, he was investigating a non-arrestable minor misdemeanor of littering. And that's what he admitted to.
Don't we need to separate the Fourth Amendment issue from the non-territorial, non-jurisdictional issue here? I mean, let me ask you this question. If the officer was not in pursuit, but he saw the car driving without its headlights, you say what criminal activity occurred? Well, driving without headlights is a misdemeanor. Isn't that the criminal activity? And couldn't the officer have stopped him for that alone without the territorial issue here?
In East Canton, yes, where the officer is employed to be is in East Canton, and sure, that's not a problem. I think the problem arises when he crosses that line outside of his jurisdiction.
But that's the territorial. I want to get to the Fourth Amendment issue. He had reason to stop the car, did he not? Because it had no headlights. It was dark, I assume.
If you take a snapshot of just that part, which I think is what the dissent did in the Fifth District case, is just looked at the stop. Yes, a headlight out by itself, you can pull the car over. That's not a problem.
Well, you raised the issue in your sort of rhetorical question in your brief that what criminal activity did the officer witness? None. Well, I have a problem with that, I guess. It seems to me that driving without headlights is a misdemeanor. I think that's a crime.
I think what I was referring to there is when he left his jurisdiction, he had not witnessed any crimes.
That's a separate issue from his right. Let's assume he's in his jurisdiction. He has a right to stop him, certainly, does he not?
Definitely.
Okay, so then now we have the territorial issue, the jurisdiction.
Which I think
issue.
Goes beyond the statutory violation, and I think that's what Wiedemann was saying, that just because he violates the statute, which says he has to be in his jurisdiction except for certain exceptions, that just by itself, per se, is not a constitutional violation, and we would agree with that position. However, when an officer leaves his jurisdiction for no good reason, that should be considered in that balancing test. Because if we're balancing the state's right, the officer's right, his interest in protecting the public safety, his interest is protecting the public safety of the citizens of East Canton, where he's employed to be. And when he leaves that jurisdiction.
Didn't the accident which gave rise to this occur within East Canton?
An accident occurred, yes.
Right. And the implication was that it really wasn't a hit skip because the parties exchanged information. But you still have a traffic violation, though, don't you? One of them, failure to stop within assured clear distance. I don't know what else there might be, but. And wasn't the officer investigating essentially at least a traffic offense, whether that's criminal or quasi-criminal? He was out investigating. He wasn't just out searching for anybody he could find. He was out there for the purpose of investigating that particular accident.
Well, when he was cross-examined about that, what he admitted to was that the only crime he was investigating was littering because one of the vehicles left part of its headlight frame on the ground. And since he didn't witness the crime, and he doesn't know if anybody committed a crime, who that was, because he was going by what a clerk saw.
Well, there would certainly be reasonable cause to believe there was a failure to stop within assured clear distance when you hit somebody and somebody hit somebody in the rear end.
Somebody probably did commit a moving violation.
Whether he articulated that was the reason or not, in reality, that would have been a reason, would it not?
Sure. But then the question, I think, becomes his interest in protecting the people of East Canton. How is that furthered by him leaving the jurisdiction? He goes to the restaurant doesn't see anything. Goes through a trailer park, doesn't see anything. Now, he's doing all this outside of East Canton. He goes to another jurisdiction further away. What about the people in East Canton who paid him to protect them? Is following somebody for, you know, minor misdemeanor traffic offenses all throughout the county, is that furthering his interest in protecting the people of East Canton? And I think if you apply that to that balancing test that you first used in Jones and then in Wiedemann, that it, if you put that in there as a factor, it tilts it the other way and says, no, he really shouldn't be outside his jurisdiction with that little of a reason. And if you say that jurisdiction is irrelevant, as I think the state is asking you to do, I think you're going to open the door, as Justice Pfeiffer pointed out, there's no downside to these officers if they're bored in one jurisdiction, roaming around another jurisdiction.
Well, counsel, isn't that an administrative call by the mayor or chief of police or some other function as to what their duties are and what, you know, that's an internal process.
I think it is as well, and it should be. However, I think it's also a public policy argument that the court should consider. Officers.
So we should place limits on how a chief of police assigns his or her staff, officers.
I don't think any jurisdiction is ever going to say it's okay for the officer just to go wherever he wants if he's bored. I don't think you're ever going to have that situation. In fact, I don't think this factual situation is going to arise that often, because I don't think I've ever seen a case where an officer has gone so far for so little. But if you say that there's no downside, I think you're going to see more of officers leaving their jurisdictions if they're small communities like this one where there's not much going on. Whether or not their policies control that, I think it goes beyond just an internal policy.
So you would ask us to set a policy in our opinion as to advise mayors and chiefs of police how to control their staff?
How they want to handle it, you know, that's certainly going to be up to them, but I think the court should include the reason an officer leaves his jurisdiction as part of the reasonableness when you're determining whether there's a reasonable stop. That should be a part of it. If he's outside his jurisdiction, I think you need to ask, why is he outside his jurisdiction? Is he furthering protecting the citizens of?
So, Mr. Reich, how does your position coincide with Wiedemann?
Well, I think what Wiedemann did in that case, the officer had left briefly for a very good reason to check on another officer that didn't respond. He was coming right back to his jurisdiction and saw a DUI. And in that case, he had a good reason to be outside his jurisdiction. He only went as far as he needed to, as long as he needed to. It passes the standard. I mean, Wiedemann wouldn't have been changed. But you left the door open, I think, when you said that it's not just per se a violation. But in this case, it goes beyond just, he's not just outside his jurisdiction. He's outside for no good reason. And he continues to go outside further and further. And that's why I think the Fifth District analyzed every step in the chain. They started back at the first stop the officer made, the second stop he made, and saying each of these steps, he was gaining nothing.
But that's the hot pursuit issue, is it not? That's not a constitutional, under Wiedemann and other cases. That's whether he was in hot pursuit, isn't it?
Well, certainly he wasn't in hot pursuit. But I think if you put it into the reasonableness test that you talked about.
Depends on how you define hot pursuit, I guess. Or he was investigating, I guess.
He didn't see anything happen. We don't know
around
how long before it happened.
Yeah.
You know, he came on the scene minutes.
But in Wiedemann, he wasn't in hot pursuit.
What's that?
In Wiedemann, the officer was not in hot pursuit. He went to see if his colleague was in trouble or needed help. That wasn't hot pursuit, was there?
But he had a legitimate reason. I think to check on a fellow officer is a great reason. He definitely should have gone.
I don't see anything in Wiedemann that says legitimate reason, is it?
Well, that's what we're asking you to include, is that should be a factor then. Why is he outside his jurisdiction?
Well, he was outside the jurisdiction, as I understand the facts, and I could be wrong, because he was trying to find the vehicle that was involved in this accident, and he kept getting reports that the vehicle was here or there or somewhere else, and he kept going where the reports indicated the vehicle might be, in apparently to investigate the accident and find out, you know, what the cause of it was. So, but if I understand what you're saying, he just should have sat within East Canton and hoped somebody showed up to be able to explain the accident.
Well, I think a reasonable and prudent officer would have given out a description of the vehicles and the possible damage to the sheriff, to the surrounding communities, and continued to protect the citizens of East Canton. And certainly when he got to the first place, which was the only place he had any kind of description, was the closed restaurant, and there was nobody there, that he should have come back. He kept going then at that point without any reason to think he was going to find anything. He went to the trailer park, then he went further on out to Speedway before he got a report of some reckless driver. So yeah, he should have stayed. Our position would be he should have stayed in East Canton, given out the description, what he knew, and continued about his job protecting the people.
You have time for Mr. Urban?
Okay. I believe I'm taking up some of Mr. Urban's time.
Thank you, Mr. Reisch. Mr. Urban.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Your honors have raised some very important questions in analyzing this issue, and it is a constitutional issue, I believe. When the state says the jurisdiction is irrelevant, it's troubling to think that jurisdiction then becomes irrelevant if the court sides with the state's position. Jurisdiction is a very relevant part of our analysis, as it was with the Fifth District. And the Fifth District looked at jurisdiction, what happened inside that jurisdiction, the reasonable belief that the officer had while he was in his jurisdiction, and then what took him outside the jurisdiction. He crosses that line, he should be asking himself, why am I out here? What am I doing? What am I looking for? He wasn't looking for anything that was substantiated by anyone's direct evidence to him, other than he cleaned up a little bit of a mess at the intersection and went about his way. Justice Cupp, you asked, there may have been an assured clear distance problem. There was nothing, and there's nothing on the record from his testimony that indicates that. There was no testimony from the clerk that he spoke to that said that there was an assured clear distance problem or that would raise his suspicions to that. When it came down to it in cross-examination.
The fact that somebody ran into the rear end of another vehicle doesn't raise suspicion of assured clear distance violation in your mind?
The fact alone does, but what I'm saying is that there was no other corroborating eyewitness testimony to him that would have corroborated that suspicion, and he never relayed that to us during the course of the suppression hearing. There were a multitude of things that he did not relay to us. He was at the Village Hall. He was supposed to be there, I believe, either watching over the mayor's court or village council proceedings. He left that to leave his jurisdiction. A reasonably prudent officer should have called for backup from another jurisdiction. If he believed there was a serious crime being committed, that officer from the other jurisdiction would have been there with him if it was, in fact, a hot pursuit. It wasn't. The pursuit is based on these nebulous claims that there were people calling in, or another person called in, and then another person that he said he saw while he was almost 3 miles outside of his jurisdiction. Those claims he only testified to. They were not substantiated by any other witnesses at the suppression hearing. So our point was that each step along the way, he had choices. He could have turned back and gone to his jurisdiction since he saw no evidence at the Coyote restaurant that they had been there, no evidence of other car parts laying around. I believe he testified to that in the suppression hearing. So that evidence then should trigger to a reasonably prudent officer, I need help. I'm getting further out of my jurisdiction. I'm getting further away from the people I'm supposed to be protecting. Please, someone come out and help me. There may be a problem here. He never did that. And jurisdiction matters because in our analysis, it's the starting point. It is the absolute starting point. In all the cases we cite, in all the cases the state cites, all those cases deal with things that happen immediately within the jurisdiction or just outside.
And counsel, if he would have been a quarter of a mile over the line and saw this vehicle without headlights and had a report from a motorist that he was almost hit by someone driving without headlights at night, you're okay with that?
Again, the circumstances would dictate.
Well, given these circumstances.
The interesting thing about that question, Your Honor, is that how I perceive it, the road he was on, as you exit the jurisdiction of East Canton, it's on a hill, so he can see quite a bit. And 172 is a pretty straight shot, so he can see even more than normal. So if in this situation, he was a quarter mile outside of his jurisdiction, given the layout of the land, and he witnesses that, and he has not gone to the Coyote yet to look around and waste time there to find nothing, I think if he sees that as the car is traveling away with no rear lights, or no headlights illuminated, because he probably could see it from a quarter mile, he should pursue, but he should call. for backup. He's getting further and further out of his jurisdiction. He's leaving in a small village, that village unattended. He needs assistance from the people in the from the officers in the jurisdiction he's heading into. What we're saying is, in these circumstances, all of them together, when they add up, made this stop unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. The balancing test that we apply, as well as the test that you've established in Wiedemann, where just the jurisdiction outside the jurisdiction is not per se, that's true, that's right, that is correct. It's all of the circumstances together. We can't just throw the Fourth Amendment aside. You're correct, Justice Moore, Chief Justice, when you say that, because the Fourth Amendment is so important here. And we're saying that these circumstances rise to that level. There's nothing else, so I think my time is just up.
Thank you, Mr. Urban. Mr. Caldwell, you save 5 minutes of your time.
Just briefly, Your Honor, I think you've hit the nail on the head, Justice Kopp. This officer did have legitimate reasons to respond to investigate this accident. He was just not out on a fishing expedition. He was getting reports as to the location of this vehicle. He was immediately proceeding to those locations. And one should not get the impression that he was roaming all over the county or all over the state. The distance here is less than 3 miles. In fact, the officer testified that from the spot where he made the traffic stop to the accident site was 1.25 miles. And all this took place in a relatively short span of time as well.
Counsel, I'm still struggling with what the applicable law is to be applied to this case. Is it Wiedemann? Is it Justice Cook's concurrence in Wiedemann? Or is it a U.S. Supreme Court case?
It's a combination of the majority's opinion in Wiedemann as well as the Supreme Court decision.
And which case?
Virginia versus Moore.
Okay. And the Court of Appeals did not consider Virginia versus Moore?
That's correct, but they didn't do so for a very good reason. The case had not been decided.
All right. So that's their analysis. If you didn't have the U.S. Supreme Court case, then it's just a matter of was their analysis of Wiedemann?
That's correct.
Correct or incorrect?
That's correct. It's our position it's incorrect. Wiedemann itself, as has been pointed out, there was no criminal activity involved in the jurisdiction itself or gave rise to the reason why the officer left the jurisdiction. Again, he went out to check on the status of a fellow officer. And I think it's problematic once we get into the area of what's legitimate and what's not legitimate. And I guess I would make the analogy to the pretextual stop area.
But your interpretation of the U.S. Supreme Court case would mean that Wiedemann is no longer the law either. It's Justice Cook's concurrence would be the law.
Correct.
Where she says, Fourth Amendment doesn't stop this, or this, you know, the fact that he's violating
the statute
doesn't make a Fourth Amendment violation. End of the question.
That's correct.
Was the Fourth Amendment the only issue raised about the officer's authority to stop and arrest in this particular case?
Yes, I believe so. I mean, they did argue that they tried to argue the statutory violation, that the officer did not have authority to pursuant to the statute. But again, that argument was pretty much nipped in the bud because of this court's Holland decision.
Counsel, what I have gotten from the opposing counsel is that basically they want us to develop a balancing test as to when it's reasonable for an officer to do an activity such as was done here. Is that your impression too?
Yes.
And if there was, first of all, do you think there's a need for us to do that? And if you would, what would your balancing test be?
Well, no, I don't think there is a need, number one. But number two, if you were to balance, I think some of the factors you'd want to look at are, again, the reason why the officer is outside his jurisdiction, the length of time he's outside the jurisdiction, as well as the distance traveled outside the jurisdiction. And I think if you look at those factors in the context of this case, the conclusion is that this officer did not exceed his statutory authority to the extent that he became some rogue cop that was out there looking for crime to investigate. In conclusion, therefore, this court should reverse the Court of Appeals decision and reinstate the convictions of the defendants. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Caldwell. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.